Wait in town and tell the people about the musical things coming your way.
And I'm going to tell you right now, unless we can be successful in creating a real free press where the American people get different viewpoints other than those expressed in the establishment-controlled media, there's going to be a civil war in this country, and it's going to come soon. The only thing that can stop it is by waking up vast amounts of sleeping people. Sheeple is what they are. They are following the Judas goat right into the shearing pens, and from there they will go to the slaughter, and they will not know that anything is wrong until they smell the blood of the sheeple in front of them.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill, and me, Tony Gosling. Mike Pence and Benjamin Netanyahu arrived to lobby Boris on his first week in the Common. Meanwhile, the US State Department offers millions of dollars in bribes to the captain of the Iranian oil tanker. It used to be called the Grace One, but it's had a paint job. It's now been called, renamed the Adrian Daria, and that was in Gibraltar, but the tanker has now gone dark, as they say, switched off its various little devices that enable it to be tracked. Brian Hook from the US wanted the ship to sail to a friendly US port so she could be impounded, but the captain said no to his $50 million bribe. And Hong Kong comes back from the brink, a real test for the demonstrators, as Carrie Lam withdraws the China extradition bill permanently in an enormous climb down by Beijing. And Epstein, more on him, with an expert on Zionist organised crime. That's Gilad Atzmon, the musician, and the UK angle. Who is Nicole Junkerman, apart from being Epstein's friend, running IT here at the National Health Service? Also from last week, Norman Dodd on how our entire education system, from primary to universities, has been subverted to the agenda of the financial oligarchy. Well, the new world order that doesn't exist. Our sister show Dialects here at BCFM, Tuesday at noon this week, insights into Epstein's elite child sex trafficking ring and an apparently suicided suspect from Israeli-born musician and blogger Gilad Atzmon. Full interview there. And a former US diplomat working in Saudi Arabia, Michael Springman, explains how the US created and funded Islamic terrorism and how now it also benefits from the Mediterranean migrant crisis. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download that show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, let's start straight away with Mike Pence and Benjamin Netanyahu arriving to lobby Boris on his first week at the Commons. What do you think, mate? Obviously, there are certain things that get said in front of the cameras, but what's this trip really all about?
Well, obviously, I've got no inside information, but I would have thought...
How about a bit of educated guesswork?
I think that Pence will have come to talk a little bit about Brexit, but not much. They just want it to happen. I mean, Pence is, and Trump are fairly clearly in favour of that. But he's more talking about, you know, we're getting a gang together to go to war in the Middle East, and that's what Netanyahu's come for.
Kevin, do you think it's more about trying to get a trade deal with Brexit potentially happening, or do you think it's about Middle East wars? Or
it's
both?
It's about Middle East war, and as you know, I followed up. Last week, some thermonuclear bombers flew along our south coast over Brighton, American super nuclear bombers.
So what are these bombers exactly?
They're called B-2 Spirits.
These are the sort of flying wing things.
Yeah, they look like a flying wing.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be invisible to radar. They're not. But I asked the RAF, you know, what was the point of these planes? We have strategic bombs, but we have no strategic bombers. So he passed me to the American Air Force, where I spoke to some charming chaps. And they said flights like that were for training purposes, and they were organized with the host nation. So the United Kingdom invited the United States to fly these strategic bombers over Brighton.
We've also had the first visit of Israeli Air Force jets to Britain, haven't we? I think it was RAF Waddington, which is really USAF Waddington, where they fly these unmarked military transport planes out with no national markings on. You know, they care that much about the Geneva Convention and things like that out of Waddington. But so the Israelis have been here too, Kevin. Do you think that's significant?
Yeah. No, you asked the question yourself, Tony. What are Pence and Netanyahu doing here? Go back to last Thursday and say, what are strategic bombers doing flying over Brighton? The bombers belong to the United States. The United States shipped them over here. They're not normally based here. So something's happening.
Also, increased stockpiling of nuclear weapons at Fairford. What evidence have you got for that?
Again, from the American, the bombers don't fly without access to the bombs. You know, they may not carry them on a training exercise over Brighton, although I'm not sure about that. But they will not be flown from the United States to Britain unless there are bombs there that they can pick up and carry and drop if that happens. I think the whole exercise in Pence and Netanyahu is to threaten Iran.
What evidence have you got, though, for any more nukes arriving at Fairford? I mean, it's just only up the road here, isn't it? It's a sort of, what is it, 40-minute drive or so? No, an hour-long drive, I suppose, to Fairford.
No, it's called standing operating procedures. If you, the United States now has three of these bombers, which cost, wait for this, $1.2 billion each.
Is that the B-2 Spirit?
The B-2 Spirit's 1.2.
Yeah, you better. I think the pilot might get his knuckles wrapped if he lands it a bit heavy.
If he crashes one of these into Brighton. Bad thing.
Well, even if you crunch it a little bit on the landing, you're in real trouble there.
Well, anyway, you break the wheels and it's probably $100 million down the pan.
Well, I actually spoke to Roger Sanders, who's a former Labour councillor in Stroud, earlier this week about Fairford. This is what he had to say about the presence of these B-2 bombers. One of the things always worth mentioning in situations like this is how wonderful these guys with the little vacuums and the plane spotters are. They did a great deal of good, didn't they, in actually identifying the aircraft that were being used for extraordinary rendition, Kevin?
It was the plane spotters who virtually exposed that almost by themselves.
And I think there's quite a lot going on at Shannon before we hear from Fairford too, isn't there?
Yeah. The American bombers were flown here to Fairford. They didn't stop off in Shannon.
But a lot of stuff does. For example, when there are troop replacements in Afghanistan, in Middle East or wherever, the Americans seem to be all over the world these days, wherever they're being, Somalia, places like that in Africa, Germany, the replacements are made through
Shannon
a lot of the time. Anyway, let's go to Roger Sanders now, former Labour councillor, as I said, from Stroud. But his take on what's going on at Fairford at the moment with the arrival of these, for the first time, these B-2 Spirit bombers there.
I'm Roger Sanders. I'm a resident of Stroud. I've been involved in local authorities most of my life. I mean, Fairford literally shut down for years. And now it's gradually turning back into an operational site. And the information is that they're going to turn it into a full operational, like KC-135. There's huge planes, those big starlifters, in and out all the time. God knows what they're delivering. In both Iraqi wars, it was a major base in the Serbian conflict. Direct. Yeah, they used to leave Fairford, go and do the bombing and come back to Fairford. I believe there was in-flight refueling, which took place as well. You know, that's all the bombers, the B-1s, B-52s. They're made to fly direct to those countries. They don't land, they don't base up, and they come straight back to Fairford again. In the past, there's been real strong objections from Stroudan District about the site. You know, people a bit like Greenham Common, people chaining themselves to the fence, breaking and all sorts of things. What I think is really a bit concerning these days is everybody is saying, wow, the nukes are back in town. Let's go up and see them, have a picnic, you know? And that's what concerns me more than anything, actually, is to see people accepting these things as being just a normal, fun run of life, like, you know?
Yeah, well, during the run-up to the Iraq war in 2003, we used to go down every month and eventually every week to try and blockade Fairford, because it's not far away. And we had something called the Gloucestershire Weapons Inspectors, who would turn up in white coats and demand to be let in to look at the weapons of mass destruction inside Fairford. And, of course, some people broke in and tried to damage the planes, and they went to court in Bristol Crown Court and so on. I would argue that we shouldn't have any US bases in our country. We need sovereignty. The French kicked them out in 1960. Because they're trying to.
Some people will be familiar with Fairford. Back in July, they had the International Air Tattoo there. They'll have been taking photos of and watching these planes go by.
Yeah, well, of course, for the right, that's what the gentleman's just suggesting, that it's people looking at this as if it's some kind of a entertaining spectacle. And, of course, there's every possibility that it could end in a catastrophe. I was on RT last week talking about the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, because, of course, the Americans have withdrawn from that treaty after, you know, it signed at the end, you know, Mr. cruise missiles were taken from Greenham Common and all the rest of it because of the treaty. The Americans withdrew from it and then immediately tested a missile which would have contravened the treaty, and Putin made a speech saying, well, this is ridiculous, you know, you withdraw from the treaty and then the very next week you come out that you've actually not been abiding by it anyway. Why should we trust you to sign any deals with us about anything?
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Mike Pence, just a little clip of him in front of the cameras at Downing Street.
I spoke to President Trump this morning, your friend, and he asked me to send you his very best greetings and to assure you that the United States supports the United Kingdom's decision to leave the European Union. We're anxious to stand with you and to do everything in our power to strengthen what has been a historic and special relationship between the United States of America and the United Kingdom. And it is embodied in the very warm and personal relationship that you have forged with President Trump, with myself, and with our administration. And I'm truly honored to be here.
Mike, it's fantastic to have you, and we will make sure that we do everything to increase free trade, but the National Health Service is always worth saying, for the benefit of UK media here, the National Health Service is not on the table as far as our negotiations go, and we're not too keen on that chlorinated chicken either. We have a gigantic chlorinated chicken of our own here on the opposition benches. Anyway, I'm being asked to shut.
I mean, really, effectively, what you're saying, Kevin, is this whole thing is a lie and a distraction that they're talking about here.
Yeah. One of the most respected commentators in the Irish Republic, Miriam Lord, described Pence's visit as you roll out the red carpet, you welcome him, and then when he leaves for London, you find he shat on your carpet.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he's going to get a very different welcome from the government in Britain and the government in Ireland because of the Brexit stuff. But, of course, the real problem is that the Americans and the Israelis and others have got an agenda which isn't to do with Brexit at all. It's to have a war, basically. The Israelis are pretty clear. They want a war with Iran. There's no doubt about it. And in Lebanon, what happened in Lebanon is fascinating, Tony, because after the attack on the Hezbollah communications centre that killed two people.
Is this what we were talking about last week?
Yeah.
So we had, okay, just to put people in the picture, this is the Israelis not last weekend, the weekend before, attacking three countries, Iraq, Lebanon and Syria, all in the same weekend, with impunity, apparently.
Yeah, but what they did in Lebanon is they killed a couple of Hezbollah people who were basically journalists, and Hezbollah struck back.
So that's
back.
Right, it was a communication
centre. Yes, communication centre, but yeah. Hezbollah struck back, and the Israelis haven't reported this, and Hezbollah haven't said anything about it either, but the stuff I've been reading suggests that they killed a top Israeli general. They infiltrated over the border, they fired a Russian-made rocket at his armoured vehicle and killed him. And, of course, that was the answer to the attack that the Israelis had carried out on them the other week. And, of course, both sides then stopped. Andrei Vilchek's got a very good article about this. He said, in actual fact, what's happened there is both sides looked into the abyss and turned away. But we don't really know more than that.
OK, we'll put a link up to they'll find that and put a link up
to it. It's on the New Eastern Outlook.
Our show page at thisweek.org.uk. What do you make of this exchange between the Israelis and Hezbollah? And why should they deny it? I mean, you know, if the Israelis have had a general killed or a senior officer?
Yeah, I mean, I would follow Tony. I think Tony's spot on. They both, you know, they started firing at each other, suddenly realised it could escalate, and escalation is Armageddon.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
right. I mean, they didn't want to talk about it because the Israelis don't want to admit that Hezbollah could do something like that to them. And Hezbollah are quite happy to just keep it under wraps as long as the Israelis get the message, don't mess with us.
So Benjamin Netanyahu arrives as this butter wouldn't melt in his mouth.
Of course, it's always a pleasure to see you. But especially now in your role as Prime Minister, I want to say that you've been a great friend of the Jewish people in Israel. I applaud your staunch stance against anti-Semitism. Your support for Israel's security. Our relations are at an all-time high in economically, trade, technology, defense cooperation. These are all great things. It's not that we lack challenges. We have the challenge of Iran's aggression and terrorism. And I'd like to talk to you about how we can work together to counter these things for the benefit of peace.
Boris wasn't with it when Netanyahu was talking to him. And quite suddenly, out of the blue, Boris pipes up with the two-state solution. And you can see Netanyahu thinking, where's this guy coming from? But it is totally improper for Boris Johnson to be beating up on the leader of the opposition to foreign visitors. I didn't think we did that here.
So he's talking about a two-state solution. And this, I imagine, is not what Benjamin Netanyahu really wants to hear.
No, he looked at... No. He's spitting... You know, spitting.
Was that just? Would you think that's just Boris buffoonery, or is there?
Well, no. I think the British position in theory is that there's going to be a two-state solution. It's rapidly, people on the ground are rapidly losing any faith in it. But what he did there was to try and cover his own backside. If he was seen to be sucking up too much to Netanyahu, he's got to say the British position is two-state solution. And Netanyahu, basically, you've got to ask the question, when Boris Johnson becomes Prime Minister and you get the, you know, far-right Pence from the United States and far-right leader in,
Racist. He's passing passing racist legislation.
He's carried out attacks which are absolutely illegal in international law. Yeah? Those people he killed in Lebanon, in actual fact, it's backfired in Lebanon, because even Hariri, who is pro-Saudi, and he's got joint Saudi citizenship, he's the Prime Minister, said it was unacceptable. Michel Aoun, who's the President, who's a Christian, said it was, that we're ready to go to war with Israel. And Hezbollah just said, don't do that again, okay. And we'll show you what
so
to
if
do.
You were
we'll
a fly we'll on kill the wall, you were a fly on the wall in Downing Street, with Pence and Netanyahu and Boris, what was going on?
They're talking about that the Israelis want a war with Iran. And they want to have a war. They're backed off from having a war with Hezbollah because they suddenly realise they'd take a lot of punishment. And that's what Vilcek's
asking. How on earth are they going to persuade Boris to go along with that?
Well, Boris is obviously preoccupied with other issues, but nevertheless, the real world does impinge. There could be, before Brexit this year, a stock market crash for all kinds of reasons which we've been talking about earlier. And a stock market crash and a war in the Middle East will definitely upstage Brexit in the Christmas dinner conversations.
And finally, what about RAF Waddington's Operation Cobra Warrior? Israeli Air Force F-15 fighter jets are among the sought after, this is the BBC, by the way, aircraft aviation fans are gathering to see at an international training exercise. Plane spotters from across Europe have turned up in numbers to see jets from Italy and Germany as well as the UK and Israel taking part in Operation Cobra Warrior. The training exercise is taking place at RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire. But the first time we've had Israeli, why are Israeli jets here?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure it's the very first time they've been here. I'd suggest that. I mean, don't forget, it is a big show.
No, for an exercise, yeah?
Well, I mean, why are we doing exercises with the State of Israel, which is actually in defiance of the United Nations, in possession of territory which they shouldn't be holding? We went to war with Serbia, and the RAF bombed the Serbs for 73 days, and we killed 10,000 people, mostly civilians.
So it's being reported, Israeli Air Force and RAF conducting historic joint exercises. They haven't conducted these joint exercises before. Also, Kevin, you wanted to bring up something about migrants crossing the channel. Well, was that tongue-in-cheek or not? The site of the B2s down in Brighton.
Very quickly. The B2s are over the English Channel, right? The two countries on either side of the English Channel have strategic bombs, but no strategic bombers. So was this a sales pitch? You know, look at our gorgeous B1s. $1.2 billion to you, cheap at half the price. Was it a sales pitch? But no, I think seriously, the conversation between Pence, Netanyahu and Boris was about war with Iran.
Are we airstrip one?
I think we are, aren't we? Let's face it. What very interesting thing this week, which probably the most listeners won't have heard, is that Putin made a speech where he said, I've offered Trump to sell him our latest nuclear weapons that we've developed, the hypersonic nuclear weapons, which we ran out 2 years ago. I've said, you can buy them from us, because the Americans are now trying to develop their own to compete with the Russians. And he said, we'll sell you them, because they're unusable. But if you pay them, pay us for them, we will give. We've already got them on, off the peg for you. Bit cheeky, eh?
Okay, so let's staying with the Israeli theme, the links anyway between Epstein and Israel. I spoke to and technology. In fact, we can talk a bit about that as well, Kevin. I spoke to an investigative writer and speaker on internet radio, that sort of thing, called Johnny Vedmore. He wrote a fascinating article saying that the person that no one seems to have noticed that Epstein is very friendly with, who was having these trips with him on his own on the Lolita Express jet, with no girls, nothing seemed to be involved with some sort of underage sex trafficking ring, but is this woman Nicole Junkerman, who just happens to be right at the very top now of the National Health Service, deciding on all sorts of important policies to do with technology at the NHS. So let's have a listen to Johnny, I spoke to earlier in the week.
Epstein and Junkerman, when I first looked into it, I couldn't find any sort of understandable link why she would be there. Maybe she was 27 at that time, and she was already she'd finished her second degree, and by the time she'd finished her first degree, she was already a multi-millionaire businesswoman. With it's very hard to trace how she became a multi-millionaire businesswoman before she was at the age of like 20 or something. But the same as it, with Epstein. Or any of the associates like Wexner, etc. It's very when you look at how they made their money, it kind of like, oh, they made a bit of money here, and then suddenly they were billionaires, and they had lots and lots. Well, Junkerman was one of these, so she could be there trying at that period, trying to get into Epstein's books for some funding for some projects and maybe some investment. Later on, after my first article came out, people did link that Epstein was directly involved with Carbine 9/11, which is the company Nicole Junkerman is director of, who the chairman of the company is Ehud Barak, who is the Prime Minister of Israel and the head of intelligence at one point.
Well, I mean, we're a murky world, a tiny corner of it is being exposed by what's been coming out in the media about all of this. Basically, Mossad have been working for many years to blackmail and control Western politicians and business leaders.
And to actually get their ideas, get right into the top of the civil service in this case. Yeah. And a £250 million fund, for example, has just been given to for NHS Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, which Nicole Junkerman is one of the people who's been involved in, you know, making this happen.
Well, I've never heard
it's
of
a lot of money.
I've never heard of her before, but it's an extraordinary thing that somebody like that, who's a private sector billionaire, ends up running the health service. Who decided that?
All you need to do is look at any kind of news around the NHS and technology. For example, NHS patient data is worth £5 billion, apparently, to private companies. This is one of the
reasons. Yeah, insurance companies would love to get their hands on it.
They want to, and that's a lot of money too,
no,
Kevin.
It's much worse than that. The health data is one of the targets of the illegal American surveillance in this country. Mm-hmm. It's a deliberate target. They're collecting the health data so that they can make, you know, better medicines to sell for money. This is not a charitable enterprise.
And just literally an hour ago in The Guardian, NHS Gender Identity Clinic has disclosed email contacts of 2,000 patients. One of the people affected describes the incident as a horrendous breach of privacy. Almost 2,000 patients of an NHS gender identity clinic have had their email addresses disclosed in a horrendous breach. These involved are patients of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Foundation Trust in London who are transitioning gender or considering doing so. Their email addresses were all included and therefore left visible in an email by an official at the Trust on Friday afternoon that should have been sent to recipients on a blind carbon copy basis. So it doesn't sound as if they're really taking the sort of care they should be, Kevin, over privacy.
No, not at all. The person responsible for stopping illegal surveillance and the illegal theft of patients' data is the Information Commissioner. Instead of being, you know, nailed to the wall, she was given a CBE for doing nothing. She has taken no effective action at all. She's looking at this complaint, you just mentioned it, the patient's data in London, allegedly for artificial intelligence. Well, any scientist will tell you, if you can't define something, you're unlikely to be able to build it. If you can't define intelligence, you're not going to be able to define what the artificial version is.
Okay, well, whilst we're on artificial intelligence, fascinating story this week. I tweeted earlier this week, so I was so glad the United States won the space race. Now they and their Israeli chums can see what every country is doing, from surveillance satellites, anything they don't like, they can bomb it. This is in the New York Times. Trump has tweeted a picture of an Iranian missile explosion from a satellite. Now, again, a bit like earlier on, Martin, where we heard the potential of a senior Israeli officer being killed and that not being announced to the public, it looks like a massive attack has been made on an Iranian missile site, which also wasn't reported.
Well, Trump's just tweeted it, so in a sense, that's you know.
But it's been reported by the Americans because the Iranians haven't said anything about it.
Well, yeah, well, of course, in the run up to war, people are paying blindsides, aren't they?
It makes you realise just how much we don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, the other thing is there was a story, I'm just trying to find again, about artificial intelligence and nuclear weapons, requests to give artificial intelligence the ability to launch nuclear weapons in case the people who are supposed to launch them have been killed, Kevin.
Well, like I said, it would be the most unreliable targeting system ever invented, because you can't define intelligence, you can't define the artificial version, and you then put this creation in charge of firing nuclear weapons.
It sounds like the Doomsday Machine from Doctor Strange.
Except worse.
Actually, I think there was a whole film about it, wasn't it? It was called The Forbin Project or something. I seem to remember seeing that years and years ago and thinking, crikey, this is quite good, interesting. The idea of handing these sorts of decisions over to AI, I mean, that doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense, Kevin. I mean, can there be checks and balances? Apparently there are on the stock market, with the idea of, programs to buy and sell shares.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine because nobody gets killed, or not normally. But if you're putting life and death decisions in the hands of technology where the basis is insecure and undefined, you're really going out on a limb. It's not science fiction.
Another bit of news about Greenland. I mean, we heard all about Trump offering to buy Greenland, didn't we? And then, you know, actually invited himself to go over to see to Copenhagen to see the Danish leaders, and then said, oh, by the way, we want to put the sale of Greenland on the agenda. And when the Danes said, no, you're not going to do that, he then said, oh, well, we're not coming then, in a fit of humpery. But anyway, either of you know why? Why Greenland is so, you know, interesting?
There are two reasons. Two reasons. A, it's strategic. If you look at its location, yeah, for things like short-range missiles to hit the Russians, etc. They've got a base there. The Americans have got a base there. Okay. Truman offered to buy it in the 1940s for that reason. But obviously the Danes at that stage, even though they were, you know, had been just been under the occupation of the Germans or whatever, weren't going to go down that road because they just think it's silly. The other thing is, in Greenland, as the Arctic melts, and it's funny, people are global warming sceptics, all agree that everybody agrees the Arctic is melting, and the oil companies definitely agree because they're all scrambling to get, as it melts, you can access all sorts of oil, diamonds, minerals, rare earth materials, etc. And the Chinese have been coming to the Greenlanders and saying, hey, we'd like to get some of that stuff.
That's right, rare earth minerals. And that means maybe they won't be able to buy them from China in the future. So maybe they're thinking about having a war with China.
Well, of course they are. Everybody is preparing for a world war. And of course, that wasn't what, when the Berlin Wall came down, we thought we weren't going to be doing that anymore. I knew that wouldn't be the case. But,
okay.
Experts,
always be easy to be wise after the event. Experts want to give control of America's nuclear missiles to artificial intelligence. If America is attacked with a nuclear bomb, AI would automatically fire back. I've found the article now. Even if we are all dead. This is in Vice.com. When it comes to nukes and the Cold War, Kevin, everything old is new again. Old treaties against the creation of long-range nuclear weapons are dead. Russia is working on new nukes. It promises can strike the US in record time. It does seem as if all the various safeguards that keep us all safe are slowly crumbling.
Well, that's Trump's approach. Trump doesn't understand complexity. You know, those treaties took time, and it's because the people at the time were scared witless of a nuclear war.
But the Americans will say, well, actually, it's the Russians that broke this Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. They developed a missile which wasn't within it.
The Russians would say we didn't, and in any case, a short-range missile from Russia can't hit anything in America apart from in Alaska. Short-range missiles in the West are right in the face of the Russians. And don't forget that NATO strategic doctrine, most people in the West don't realise this, NATO strategic doctrine is to say that we won't use nuclear weapons first.
Let's try and wind up our discussion.
And if you do that, then that's the other side have to presume that you are going to use nuclear weapons first. The Russians and the Chinese will always say we won't do that.
Let's try and wind up our discussion about war by hearing from the wonderful Brian Hook. He's the US Special Representative to Iran. I suppose it's where we started talking about the tanker. Here he is announcing all sorts of money available for anyone that will do give him information or helpful, useful things to do with Iran. That seems to be his only role, is a guy dishing out money to do with Iran.
Today, the United States government is intensifying our maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran. First, we are announcing a reward of up to $15 million for any person who helps us disrupt the financial operations of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps and Quds Force. This offer is being made through the State Department's Rewards for Justice program. This program gives individuals an incentive to work with the United States to bring terrorists to justice and to prevent acts of terrorism globally. Rewards for Justice has paid more than $150 million to over 100 people in return for information that either prevented acts of terrorism or brought people to justice. And the program's motto is, stop a terrorist, save lives. Today's announcement is historic. It's the first time that the United States has offered a reward for information that disrupts a government entity's financial operations. We have taken this step because the IRGC operates more like a terrorist organization than it does a government.
Now, Kevin, we were talking about this a bit earlier, and I said $50 million. You said $50 million to me off air, but I mean, what the officials are saying is that several million dollars have been offered to the captain of this tanker. What does that tell us about the Americans? Seem to be sort of, isn't this whole idea of bribing people the kind of last thing you can possibly do when you've actually lost any traction on trying to get the Europeans and the people in the Mediterranean to do what you want?
Well, people forget our own history. That's how we tamed the Cornish pirates. First we bribed them, then we gave them licenses, and then we gave them titles.
I think what he's saying there about we're offering money openly like this and that the Iranians are terrorists, I mean, that's just, I mean, the Saudis, the Wahhabis, the Salafis, they're the real terrorists. And of course,
but I mean, surely, I mean, we talk about the SAS and special forces from the UK as being acting like terrorists. And he's saying that what Hook there is saying is that the equivalent organisations in Iran are terrorists.
Well, everybody can bandy this word terrorism around, but in actual fact, the US is spending taxpayers' money in the billions of dollars all over the world to fix elections, assassinate political enemies, and it's not something they've just started doing with Trump. They've been doing it ever since World War II. And the whole world outside the bubble in the West is very well aware of how the West operates. This is we're basically gangster states. That's what it is. And, of course, a lot of the so-called Islamist terrorism, which we're supposed to be so terrified of, is orchestrated from inside our own intelligence structure, as we've discussed in great detail on this show over the last 11 years.
OK, what do you make of what's happened in Hong Kong? Because they seem to have come back from the brink there. There's Carrie Lam, the chief. I don't know quite what her role is, her title. But she's decided that actually she's going to withdraw this bill completely, which will allow extradition for the courts in Hong Kong into China. Do you think there'll be big demos tomorrow? Firstly, Kevin, what do you think?
I haven't followed closely enough this week. There were some distractions in London. In a sense, the protesters have kind of won.
But will they go back to the streets, even though this is one of their main aims? They're saying, well, we don't want this extradition bill. That's why they came out on the street in the first place.
Well, they've added...
And they've added quite a few more. Do you think they'll be out tomorrow? I'm just asking you to use your educated guesswork crystal ball. If you were one of these people who'd been protesting, would you say, okay, well, it's time to give it a rest now, or would you carry on?
I'd stop now and negotiate, because they've made their point.
Martin?
I think that's right, but some of them won't. And I think what the signal is being sent by Beijing is we are prepared to bend, but don't push us too far, because we've got all these other things. Don't forget we're in a trade war with the US and a possibly shooting war in the South China Sea. There are Chinese forces deployed inside Syria. There are Chinese forces deployed inside Venezuela, which most people don't realise.
So how do we tell in Hong Kong whether this movement is a genuine grassroots movement or whether there are elements from the CIA and MI6?
Well, I would suggest it's pretty obvious that there's elements of both. People in Hong Kong are not very happy about being part of China, it's quite clear. But on the other hand, politics being what it is, there's no way that they can escape from that, because the West can't do anything, even if they wanted to prevent the Chinese from taking over Hong Kong in an afternoon, if they wanted to do so.
Anyway, I announced at the top of the hour we were going to be looking at the Epstein case, and got an opinion from Gilad Atzmon, the Israeli-born musician, saxophonist, on this, who blogs prolifically. And he did a recent post about a horrendous Jewish child sex trafficking ring which was going to Argentina back in the late 1800s. Just as a kind of comparison.
1900s.
Late 1800s, apparently.
Well, the turn of the last century, or the century before last.
So why is that significant today? Is it significant, or is he...
Well, I mean, it's interesting historically. Because, the idea of obviously Gilad Atzmon is not Jewish, because he says he's not, but of course, genetically or whatever he is, culturally, he was born in Israel, etc. But he's pointing out that it's pretty well documented, the very, very high-level involvement in serious organised crime of Jewish mobsters like Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel in the US. They were the heads of the mob. Al Capone's a minor lieutenant, yeah? So the idea that all Jews are doctors, lawyers and scientists is not the case.
They're blackmailing, terrorizing everyone around is not something that is unique to a sexual-oriented operation a la Epstein. It is something that we see in Britain in the open. The Labour Party here has been terrorized for 3-4 years by one lobby that we may not allow to mention. The same applies to America. You as a journalist are subject to constant pressure from the same people. And what is your crime? You are expressing your views. Now, when we talk about organized crime, we can define it in positive terms to look what is it that organized crime is doing. And another way to look at organized crime is to understand what is the impact of organized crime? Why is it successful? Organized crime is an apparatus that is there to suppress our ability to point at our oppressors. If there is a mafioso who threaten your existence or your freedom to move, the one thing that you cannot do is name him or her. This is exactly the reality in which we are living. And for me, Epstein was just part of it. It just kind of helped us to see how dirty this business is. And it is not a secret, you know, this is something that you see in every news outlet, that Epstein orbit was pretty much a Zionist network. Is supposedly only one client was Wexner, who is a rabid Zionist. He was connected with Weinstein, or Weinstein, as they call him in English, with Maxwell, the daughter of Robert Maxwell, who was, according to some, a Mossad agent. We are dealing with a Zionist network that presumably is operating like an organized crime setting.
Well, Whitney Webb's articles on Mint Press about all of this are very revealing because it's got a lot of historical detail. Organized crime has worked with intelligence services. So Mossad have worked with organized crime for years. And of course, you know, in Italy in the 40s, Lucky Luciano, who's an Italian organized criminal, was let out of prison in the US to help the communists preventing to come to power as the Allies fought up the boot of Italy. There's been constant links between these two worlds.
What's your take on the whole Epstein business, Kevin?
Very similar to what Martin is saying. After the war in Italy in particular, the CIA hijacked the mafia and put them to work on behalf of America to kill off the Italian Communist Party, a great number of whom they did kill off. Murder.
So this is a sort of third force out there that's maybe connected with, potentially with, intelligence services, special forces. How do we make sense of this, Martin?
Well, it's very difficult. It's obviously the actual detail of what's going on is hidden from us quite deliberately by the people that are doing it. But the Iran-Contra affair from a few years ago, some people remember it, what was going on there is that the Contras were bringing crack cocaine into the United States through MENA Air Base, which was basically run by the American government, and they used the proceeds to fund a terrorist campaign in Nicaragua that killed about 30,000 civilians. And that's just normal business.
One of the most
people.
Fascinating things Gilad's saying there, Kevin, I think, was the ability of organised crime networks to shut down anybody that even points at them.
Yeah. No, and Italy is the case in point. But one of the things that has never been properly sort of publicised or described in the media is the extent to which the IRA in Northern Ireland got a great deal of their support from America, from the mobsters. I see Martin's raised it, from the mobsters and so on. And we must have, the United Kingdom must have known that.
Well, can I just say on that point, the IRA and the mob are in the same business, so they're on the same turf. You'll actually find that the IRA in Dublin were fighting with the mobsters and the mobsters were fighting with the IRA because they're trying to run the same rackets, yeah? And the question is, who's going to run those rackets? So you should, basically, everybody uses the same methodologies, don't they? Let's face it.
Okay, so now let's go to one of our first in our series of super brains. That's what I call them anyway. These are the people that you'll never hear on the mainstream press, mainly because there doesn't seem to be any interest in exposing some of the massive bigger picture strategic problems we have in our society. And this time we look to an education with US writer Norman Dodd.
We are now at the year 1908, which was the year that the Carnegie began operations. And in that year, the trustees, meeting for the first time, raised a specific question, which they discussed throughout the balance of the year in a very learned fashion. And the question is there any means known more effective than war assuming you wish to alter the life of an entire people. And they conclude that no more effective means than war to that end is known to humanity. So then in 1909 they raise the second question and discuss it, namely, how do we involve the United States in a war? Well, I doubt at that time if there was any subject more removed from the thinking of most of the people of this country than its involvement in a war. There were intermittent shows in the Balkans, but I doubt very much if many people even knew where the Balkans was. Then finally, they answer that question as follows. We must control the State Department. And then that very naturally raises the question of how do we do that? And they answer it by saying we must take over and control the diplomatic machinery of this country. And finally they resolve to aim at that as an objective. Then time passes, and we are eventually in a war, which would have been World War I. And at that time, they record on their minutes a shocking report in which they dispatched to President Wilson a telegram cautioning him to see that the war does not end too quickly. And finally, of course, we are, the war is over. At that time, their interest shifts over to preventing what they call a reversion of life in the United States to what it was prior to 1914, when World War I broke out. And they arrive at that point, they come to the conclusion that to prevent a reversion, we must control education in the United States. And they realize that that's a pretty big task. So it's to them, it is too big for them alone, so they approach the Rockefeller Foundation with the suggestion that that portion of education which is could be considered domestic be handled by the Rockefeller Foundation, and that portion which is international should be handled by the endowment. And they then decide that the key to the success of these two operations lay in an alteration in the teaching of American history. So they approach four of the then most prominent teachers of American history in the country, people like Charles and Mary Byrd, and their suggestion to them is, will they alter the manner in which they present this subject, and they get turned down flat. So they then decide that it is necessary for them to do, as they say, build our own stable of historians. And then they approach the Guggenheim Foundation, which specializes in fellowships, and say, when we find young men in the process of studying for doctorates in the field of American history, and we feel that they are the right caliber, will you grant them fellowships on our say-so? And the answer is yes. So under that condition, eventually they assemble 20. And they take this 20 potential teachers of American history to London. And there they're briefed into what is expected of them when, as and if, they secure appointments in keeping with the doctorates they will have earned. And that group of 20 historians ultimately becomes the nucleus of the American Historical Association.
That's Norman Dodd there speaking back in the 1980s from a YouTube clip. Kevin, it's a bit of a big ask, isn't it, to try and take on education, as apparently the Rockefeller Foundation found out there after World War One. But the idea of sort of funding specific individuals, young people, to become historians, if they're agreeing with you, is quite a powerful one.
It's more than powerful, because those young historians become lecturers, readers, and professors. And when they're in line to become professors, these organizations, you know, the Rockefeller and the Guggenheim and so on, influence the appointments. So you've warped them before you start. And then if they're going to get ahead and become professors, you're standing behind the curtain saying, stick with it, or you won't make professor. It's blackmail.
Martin?
Yeah, I mean, everybody knows that the higher education is dominated by vested interests.
I mean, things like...
Well, it's not to say that everybody in it is corrupt or
things
on the
like
take.
Things publishing, you know, printing, broadcasting are quite easy to control. You just buy it up. But education as a whole is not so easy, is it?
Well, it's not so easy in one sense, but in another sense it's very easy, because, you know, American universities need money to do stuff, and these people say, hey, we've got lots of money, but we've got various demands. You know, that happens all the time. And, of course, the only way around that is for the government to fund education and to make sure that it's all run on an above-board basis. But, of course, what's happened in higher education in this country, in the US and around the world, is it's increasingly become a business run by business people on business principles. They're not there to objectively look at history. They're there to do what the people who are paying the piper are calling for.
I think we should wind up this week by taking a look at this whole Albert Pike myth again. Well, it's a myth. Is it a myth? Is it real? Is it not? Who knows? Because this guy certainly was quite an influential figure in his day in the terms of the US Civil War. And he was in communication with the guy who was helping Garibaldi unify Italy at the same time in the 1870s. And I just came across I thought was an interesting talk about it, where the speaker describes the actual letters pertaining to the role of Freemasonry from Abraham Lincoln as well. So let's have a listen to a little short clip from that now.
He used to be a Catholic and then became a Protestant. This war would never have been possible without the sinister influence of the Jesuits. We owe it to Popery that we now see our land reddened with the blood of her noblest son.
Okay, so Jesuits, not Masons.
Abraham Lincoln, 1865, 16th President of the United States. Lincoln's private letters that were burnt by his son Robert, restated by Charles Chiniki, who was the personal confidant of the President. In a letter dated 22... January 1870, Mazzini wrote to Pike. Now, Albert Pike is this high mason who wrote the manual, if you like, of Scottish Freemasonry. He said the following: we must allow all of the federations to continue just as they are. It must appear as things are as they were in the beginning. With their systems, their central authorities, and diverse modes of correspondence between high grades of the same right, organized as they are at present, but we must create a super right, which will remain unknown, to which we will call those Masons of high degree whom we shall select. With regard to our brothers in Masonry, these men must be pledged to the strictest secrecy. Through this supreme right, we will govern all Freemasonry, which will become the one international center, the more powerful because its direction will be unknown.
Kevin, I mean, he's pointing fingers at the Jesuits, the Masons' role in US history. Do you think there's any credibility to that? The guy's name, by the way, is Jean-Pierre de Smet, who's speaking there.
Well, just look at the symbols on the American dollar. America was created by Freemasons. The Jesuits are a different thing. What the Jesuits did, relevant to the quotes you've just made, the Jesuits created the first worldwide education system, and it wasn't to educate liberals.
What was it for?
It was to educate the upper class. They had a target.
But the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, the idea that this was this a Catholic-Christian idea? Because it was very much associated with the split-off, wasn't it, from the Eastern, from the Orthodox Church. This was very firmly Roman Catholic.
Yeah, and this they were the church militant. They were Christ's soldiers, and their job was to defeat the Reformation. They launched the Counter-Reformation, but they did it by educating the children of the rich.
And what influence do you think they had in the US?
Well, the biggest religious denomination in the United States is Catholic. So they had a lot of influence. There are dozens of Catholic universities in the United States.
And Martin, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's the first time I've heard this particular particular stuff. I don't believe that people. I believe that there are people out there trying to run things, Jesuits, Masons, and so on. But it doesn't always play out the way they think because the world's actually quite complicated.
Actually, a lot of Freemasons took on the whole structure of the Jesuits. And that's one of the things that they did. Apparently,
well, Franco was very opposed to the Freemasons, and of course the right wing Jesuits and so on were anti Freemason, and the Freemasons were anti Jesuits.
So they're behind a lot of these struggles.
They hated each other,
particularly the Reformation. Anyway, time to sign off for the US owned Comcast News at 8 now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's local Brexit Party candidate for South West England, and Tar. Thanks also to former Sunday Times journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, etc., etc. Lots of books, and Who Owns Ireland as well soon, Kevin Carhill. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Have an enjoyable and relaxing BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon here. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 8, the UK is unlikely to have a general election in October after opposition parties agreed to work together to block Boris Johnson's plan. Labour, the Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru and the SNP want a Brexit delay instead, but the Prime Minister has repeatedly said he won't do that. The SNP's leader at Westminster, Ian Blackford, says if that remains the case, the way forward is clear.
Well, then he has to resign. He has to do the honourable thing. He has an instruction from Parliament. It is the law of the land. He has to enact the law of the land by going to Brussels and making sure that we get that extension that Parliament has demanded.